This is the rundown from WUFT News, exploring our community from top to bottom. I'm Kristen Shearmont-Spina. Coming up on the show, driving safety experts call this time of year the 100 deadliest days of summer for teen drivers. What can parents do to keep their teens safe? And later, WUFT sat down with one of the reporters on a new series from NPR's Embedded podcast about Seattle's Capitol Hill occupied protest, or CHOP, in the summer of 2020. But first, summer is in full swing. And if the thermometer didn't give that away, then the sight and sound of lightning and thunder are a daily reminder. But in spite of the afternoon downpours here in north central Florida, much of the state remains mired in a drought. This has the potential for significant consequences, including wildfires, as we experienced earlier this spring. WUFT host Dana Hill recently sat down with meteorologist Audrey Shirley. They began by defining exactly what constitutes a drought.
So the National Weather Service defines a drought as a deficiency in precipitation over an extended period. So essentially this means a drought happens whenever we have a lack of consistent rainfall.
How have experts determined that Florida is currently experiencing a drought?
So experts determine if Florida is in a drought like we are right now based on several factors such as rainfall totals, which we've had, you know, a lot less rainfall than normal recently. They determine it based on temperatures, water supply, soil moisture, and current climate. So each location is actually designated a dryness category ranging anywhere from abnormally dry to even being in an exceptional drought based on these factors.
Well, living in Florida, summer thunderstorms become a way of life, but it isn't like we can't expect rain 12 months a year, maybe from cold fronts that come through in the winter, for example. But what creates the weather patterns here, not just in our rainy season, but also in the cooler months?
Well, we're actually in an El Nino season right now, so this could actually strengthen as we head into the winter months. And so this means as the Pacific jet stream continues to move towards the southern United States, this could actually bring us some above average moisture and higher chances for flooding. So storm activity is expected to increase across Florida overall.
Well, Florida hasn't experienced a direct impact from a hurricane since Milton back in 2024. No one's hoping for a hurricane this year, of course, but how significant are these types of storms in terms of rainfall totals?
So hurricanes impact our rainfall totals tremendously. And in fact, since we have not had a hurricane directly impact us in just these 2 years alone, this is one of the main reasons we're actually still in a significant drought. So Milton alone dropped over 18 inches of rain in areas such as St. Petersburg, about 5 of those inches being received in only an hour. So keep in mind, this was only one storm. So to put in perspective how far behind we are with our rain totals, we would actually need about 1.5 Hurricane Milton's to get out of the drought in North Florida this month alone.
But Audrey, 5 inches in an hour is maybe not the best way to get rainfall, right?
Right. We definitely need it over a consistent period of time and not just all at once.
We're in the midst of hurricane season now. What are experts telling us to expect this year?
So Colorado State University has actually lowered their predictions this month compared to June. So we're now expecting a well below average hurricane season this year with just about 9 named storms, 4 hurricanes, and 2 major hurricanes. But just keep in mind, it only takes one storm to cause a catastrophe.
What would it take for us to be able to say that Florida is not experiencing a drought? I mean, you mentioned the kind of rainfall that would come from a hurricane. No one, as I said, wants that. Are we better off now than we were during the worst of the wildfire season this spring?
Right. So we would actually need anywhere between 14 to 25 inches of rain this month alone for Florida to be out of the drought completely. Even though we've, you know, received lots of rainfall these past several weeks from lots of rounds of storms and from the sea breeze, there have still been additional wildfires popping up about each time we have a break in the rain. So we're slowly seeing them less often than what we saw in the spring, but they're still developing overall.
Yeah, lightning is contributing, I think, to those wildfires as well. Audrey Shirley, thanks so much for joining me.
Of course, anytime.
That was meteorologist Audrey Shirley speaking with WUFT host Dana Hill about Florida's drought conditions. If you're just joining us, this is the Rundown from WUFT News. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. Florida has a lot of stories to tell. Do you know your community's history? It's time for a trivia question. Bo Diddley was a rock legend who played a key role in the transition from the blues to rock and roll. In which North Central Florida town was he buried? Stay tuned to the end of the show for the answer. The time from Memorial Day to Labor Day is known as the 100 deadly days of summer for teen drivers. In 2023, the Florida DMV reported almost 20,000 teen crashes during this time period, with over 3,000 injuries and 83 fatalities. WUFT's Natalia Lopez spoke with Rich Green, who's a member of the Florida Teen Safe Driving Coalition, about how teens can stay safe when they're driving.
The sad reality is so many crashes are avoidable. If we could just get people to slow down, drive the speed limit, put good follow distance between you and the car in front of you, and if you just did those two things, you would cut the crash rate down significantly. Now, if you start working on reducing the number of distractions that the driver could have, and remember, the number one distraction for teen drivers, do you know what it is?
I'm guessing the phone or a friend.
It's the friend. The number one distraction for a teen driver is a teen passenger. If you add a passenger to a car with a teen driver, right, a teen passenger, you double the crash risk. It is crazy how when you put a group of teens together in a car, unsupervised, you're listening to the radio. You're talking, you're enjoying yourself, and when it comes to driving, the sad reality is that a second of not paying attention can result in a fatal crash. There are going to be stories that everyone in high school has about losing a friend, you know, a classmate, and there's always someone in that group that has been touched by an auto crash. The whole idea of the 100 Days campaign is just to raise the awareness of how risky this is, and if we just make some minor adjustments, we could save so many lives. I happen to have some teenage girls, and when I was retired, and I wanted to help them, and it really became a passion for me.
What do you think is the impact, you know, in general, just of having, you know, instructors just teaching them how to drive safely?
Having a professional teach someone how to drive, I think is really important, because there's a different relationship when parents try and teach you to drive. Sadly, you can look at the parents and that's who they're role modeling the wrong thing. During the 30 minutes that you've decided to start driving with your 15-year-old that's got a learner's permit isn't going to wipe away 15 years of them observing you driving. You've got to start thinking about your child being a driver when they're small, and always try and role model good behavior.
That was Rich Green, a Gainesville driving instructor and member of the Florida Teen Safe Driving Coalition. He was talking about the time known as the 100 Deadliest Days of Summer for Teenagers, which is the period between Memorial Day and Labor Day. He was speaking there with WUFT's Natalia Lopez. This is the Rundown from WUFT News. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. Coming up later in the show, WUFT sat down with one of the reporters on a new 8-part series from NPR's Embedded podcast. You won't want to miss it. Before that, though, we're bringing back our award-winning series, Uncelebrated, people who fly under the radar yet help our world turn. That's after the break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. Things on campus have been slower lately. University of Florida students and our student reporters are working or at internships. Whatever it is, we hope they're helping someone in some way this summer. So that got us thinking about our now award-winning series from late last year called Uncelebrated. These are stories about people who fly under the radar but keep the world turning. The Public Media Journalists Association named it the best student program in America in 2026. So we thought we'd like to visit that series again during these slower months. Today, WUFT's Sophia Dinka introduces us to large animal veterinarian Dr. Joe Guevara. He's been running his vet service out of his pickup truck since 2015. On this particular day, he was checking cattle for pregnancy with the help of a group of cowboys at High Springs Ranch.
Pregnant. So next cow coming into the chute now. We're seeing if she's pregnant. I'm rectally palpating her. And she is pregnant, 6 months along. And black coffee keeps me going.
I was probably about fourth or fifth grade when I got my first animals personally that I had to raise and care for itself, and then it grew from there. We care for thousands of cattle and hundreds of families that do this, and at any given moment they could call and need our help with an emergency. So it's hard to say that there's ever an end of the day, because I am always attached to my phone. I will apologize to anybody on the radio, because I just dropped this microphone in a pile of manure.
They told me you were going to do that.
Lynn, that was between you and me, buddy. Probably my biggest influence in my journey would be my mother. Ultimately, I was raised in an agricultural family. My parents managed a dairy farm in South America and Venezuela. And then when we moved to the States, my mother became an agriculture teacher at a high school. My twin boys really like to go to the farm with me when they can. They're not quite old enough yet that I trust that they can be safe in the cow pen with a lot of emergencies that I take care of. But I have brought my kids with me on a dystocia, is when an animal is having trouble giving birth. And what's handy about kids is they got small hands. Sorry, that may be too much information. The one thing I would like people to know is I am a person, and I bring a lot of my work home with me. And not being able to save that animal, or not being able to find out the reason why these animals are sick, and not being able to accomplish that task that I set in to do for an individual and a farm, that piles up sometimes, and you do bring that home with you. My wife and I have been together since 2005. We started dating in high school and got married in college, but she really is my best friend, and I can talk to her about anything. So on those hard days, she really is my rock that I talk to. This cow is exceptionally fat.
Pregnant.
That was Dr. Joe Guevara, a large animal veterinarian checking on cattle in High Springs. His story is part of our series called Uncelebrated, People Who Fly Under the Radar Yet Help Our World Turn. This story was produced by WUFT's Sophia Dinka. If you're just joining us, this is The Rundown from WUFT News. I'm Kristen Shearmont-Spina. As a reminder, our trivia question this week: Bo Diddley was a rock legend who played a key role in the transition from the blues to rock and roll. In which North Central Florida town was he buried? The answer's coming up at the end of the show. That's after a quick break and more stories from The Rundown. WUFT sat down with one of the reporters of a new 8-part series from NPR's Embedded podcast. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Kristen Shearmont-Spina. Embedded is NPR's investigative audio documentary series that explores untold stories and hidden aspects of major news events through in-depth reporting. Their latest 8-part series is called We Keep Us Safe. It's a partnership with NPR, the Seattle Times, and KUOW. The series investigates the death of a 16-year-old, Antonio Mays Jr., during Seattle's Capitol Hill-occupied protest, or CHOP, in the summer of 2020. Less than a week after he arrived, he was shot and killed there, and the case remains unsolved. Reporters Sydney Brownstone and David Gutman of the Seattle Times and Will James of KUOW dig deep into the origins of CHOP and the circles of silence surrounding Antonio's death. WUFT's Glenn Richards spoke to Will James of KUOW about the series.
Remind us about CHOP.
In the summer of 2020, when the protests around George Floyd's death were happening all over the country, they took a kind of unusual form here in Seattle, what I would say is like a very Seattle form. It wasn't just a protest. There were many marches, like there were in many cities. But protesters actually came to occupy several square blocks in the center of the city. This happened after a really tense standoff with police outside a police precinct. Eventually, the police retreated. They left the precinct, and the protesters came to occupy this space. They camped there with tents. They held rallies and speeches during the day, and they held this space for about 3 weeks, during which police were very reluctant to go in. It kind of became a temporary police-free zone for a period of that summer.
All right, so what attracted you to do this story?
Well, Sydney, David, and I, we all covered the protests that summer. We all covered CHOP. And there was something about it, about CHOP itself and about Antonio's death, that felt unresolved. After Antonio was killed, CHOP ended. The city dismantled it very quickly after that. And it just felt like people in Seattle wanted to move on very quickly, that this was a bit of a stain or a scar on our city. And there just wasn't this real push to reckon with what happened there. So 5 years later, in 2025, we all kind of looked at each other and we said, this case is still unsolved. This kid's death is still just hanging out there. It's been the subject of rumors and chatter for years, but there have been really no answers about how this kid died. At the same time, it feels like CHOP itself was this unresolved chapter in our city's history. So we said, let's dig into it.
CHOP kind of became like this organism. You can see over the course of the 3 weeks that it was there, it began as one thing, evolved into something else, and then just kind of spiraled out of control. And now, hindsight, you can see like, oh, no, this is going to end badly, even though you know the end. But you don't, because it, as you say, it's unresolved. And it's amazing how you track down some of the key figures and eyewitnesses to talk to them.
This is the most interesting aspect of the podcast to me in some ways. Of course, we want answers about Antonio's death. We want to get answers for his father. But to me, it's so interesting to understand what happened to CHOP. I mean, this was an occupation that started with this burst of idealism, with this idea that protesters could change the experience of life for Black residents of Seattle, that they wouldn't have to live in fear of police violence. How did that burst of idealism end with the shooting of a Black 16-year-old who came there to protest? So tracing that transformation and understanding how movements can quickly evolve, can go off the rails, was a real draw for me to investigate this case.
That was KUOW's Will James, who spoke with WUFT's Glenn Richards about the new embedded series, We Keep Us Safe. Before we end the show today, we have another edition of Bird Note. Today's episode is about the marsh wren.
This is Bird Note. This chatty fellow is a marsh wren, a sprightly brown bird with a cocked tail. Wrens are known for their amazing singing, including loud, complex vocalizations. And they have a huge repertoire of songs. Some bird lovers have tagged the marsh wren the Heinz 57 variety bird because scientists have recorded 57 different variations of its song. That's quite a mix of notes. Listen for one often repeated phrase, though, a recurring chugging, like the sound of a sewing machine or a toy machine gun. Nightfall doesn't faze them. A male may sing straight through the night. Opinions differ when it comes to describing the singing of the marsh wren. Ornithologist Alexander Wilson said its song sounded like air bubbles forcing their way through mud. John James Audubon said its song, if song I can call it, resembles the grating of a rusty hinge. Today, though, all would agree this is just one of many species to benefit from the North American Wetlands Conservation Act. Marsh wrens usually forage out of view, hopping up only for brief moments. You're most likely to see movement among the cattails, and not even see the bird, unless it pops up on a cattail to see what you're doing. Learn more at birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
That was Bird Note, a nonprofit independent media production that inspires listeners to care about the natural world and take steps to protect it. The Rundown is a production of WUFT News out of the University of Florida College of Journalism and Communications. The team that made the show possible this week includes Dave Bereswain, Dana Hill, Audrey Shirley, Natalia Lopez, Sophia Dinka, and Glenn Richards. Special thanks to the Dean of the College, Hub Brown, and Newsroom Director, Ethan Majok. Our trivia question this week was, Bo Diddley was a rock legend who played a key role in the transition from the blues to rock and roll. In which North Central Florida town was he buried? The answer? Bronson. Bo Diddley lived in Archer for over a decade after he retired, but his gravesite is actually at Rosemary Hill Cemetery in Bronson. It features an iconic image of his red square guitar. That's it for the Rundown. I'm Kristen Shearmont-Spina.